meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, March 8th. Right off the bat, we will not be hearing Senate Bill 70 today. If anyone is in the audience to testify or hear testimony on Senate Bill 70, we have tentatively set that bill now for Thursday, March 17th, as the next hearing on this bill. We do have two bills up for introduction today. Sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 51, state vending licenses. Senator Davis sponsor and Tom Obermeyer staff. And also Senate Bill 81, the public retiree medical benefits dependents. And Senator Davis sponsor, Tom Obermeyer staff presentation. And both of these bills have a further referral to the Senate Finance Committee. To testify on or to present the bill, Senate Bill 51, state vending licenses, Senator Davis, or I'm assuming Mr. Obermeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'd like for my staff to come up. Which one are you taking, 51?
51.
Okay, that is the vending facilities and public properties. For some time, I've had people approach me on this particular bill because there was at one time preference given to blind people to set up vending machines or businesses in certain locations. It was somewhat changed, and since that time, they've had a hard time getting employment. For that reason, I have come and introduced this bill. I think there's people to testify to it and can tell you some of the concerns that they might have, but I do have Mr. Obermeyer with me. He can take you through the bill, go through the sponsor statement, and walk you through the bill at this time.
Great. Thank you, Senator Davis. Mr. Obermeyer.
Thank you. Tom Obermeyer, staff to Senator Davis. The bill before you is Senate Bill 51, an act relating to the operation of vending facilities on public property. SB 51 restores to blind persons first priority for a contract to operate a vending facility on state and other public property. This bill amends the Alaska Chance Act of 1976 to require that the State Division of Vocational Rehabilitation Business Enterprise Program provide the same first priority to blind on state and other public property as it does on federal property enforced under the Randolph-Shepard Act of 1936. The Alaska Chance Act, for the first time, added disabled persons in addition to blind in preference for vending licenses on public facilities. This loss of first priority and expansion of beneficiaries has thwarted the spirit and letter of the Randolph-Shepard Act. The resulting decrease in vending opportunities for blind merchants in Alaska exacerbated their already extraordinarily high unemployment rates among all types and severities of the disabled and the population in general. SB 51 recognizes that the blind are dissimilarly situated compared to other disabled persons who do not suffer the same degree of impairment and unemployment as an economic matter. This is an issue because the question of equal protection had come up in regards to the current law. Although the state has combined management and training opportunities for both blind and other persons with disabilities under the Business Enterprise Program of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, this bill requires that it must give first priority to the blind for vending contracts on state, federal, and other public property. And I will mention that we have a new definition of public property in this bill as well. But keep in mind that this does not prevent other people with other disabilities to get preference after priority to the blind in these matters. SB 51 comports with original legislative intent and gives first priority to the blind imposed under Alaska Statute 2315-100 prior to changes in 74 and 2006, which added persons with disabilities and severe disabilities who currently compete with the blind for licenses on vending facilities on public property. It requires that the division attempt to find and notify blind persons of vending opportunities as they arise on public property. These public properties may include, among other things, courthouses, military bases, state and federal office buildings, and other public properties. Typically, blind individuals who receive Randolph-Shepard contracts act as managers of large vending or cafeteria facilities, subcontracting with food service organizations to provide meals and or vending services on a day-to-day basis. They may also independently operate lobby concession stands or vending machine banks. In October 2009, Alaska's Business Enterprise Program had only 6 sites operating in federal facilities under Randolph Shepard and 6 sites operating in state facilities under the CHANCE Act. Keep in mind that the CHANCE Act, again, is the state interpretation of this priority. This bill would greatly expand opportunities for employment and vending locations for the blind. And I will mention that in your hearing package, and I'll point this out, is a chart. It has lines on it, and it shows you the very few facilities that are available right now for, as of October of 2009, but many of them have remained the same, for blind and or disabled in this state. Also, I would mention that this bill that you're looking at is the sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 51, and I'll give you an explanation of that. That was basically amending the word property to include the property of municipalities and school districts so that we might expand the opportunities beyond the 12 locations in Alaska for blind individuals to have vending opportunities. If you wish, I could go through the sectional analysis, or I could answer questions at this point.
Pleasure of the committee. Would you like Mr. Obermeyer to go through the sectional analysis? This is the first time we've heard it. Mr. Obermeyer.
The Section 1 amends a section dealing with the powers and duties of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. It removes references to persons with severe disabilities from the provisions dealing with the operation of vending facilities on public property. Section 2 directs the agency to issue a license for the operation of vending facilities on public property to blind persons who meet certain criteria, including criteria established by agency regulations. It requires these regulations to provide blind persons with first priority for a contract to operate a vending facility on public property. Section 3 adds new sections to the section on the issuance of licenses for vending facilities on public property. Section 2315.133 allows the agency to contract with a person who is not blind to operate a vending facility until the agency can locate a person who qualifies to operate the vending facility. Section 2315.133D, as in Delta, says that when there is a vacancy in the operation of a vending facility on state, municipal, or school district property, it requires the agency to attempt to contact blind persons directly about operating the facility. It directs the agency to work with private organizations to contact blind persons. This requirement is in addition to any other procurement requirements of AS 36.30, the state procurement code, and newspaper advertising is not sufficient. Section 2315.133E, as an echo, allows a blind person operating a vending facility to operate another vending facility if the agency cannot find a blind person to operate the other vending facility. Section 4 deletes reference to persons with severe disabilities from a provision relating to hearings on agency actions that relate to vending facilities. Section 5 amends the definition of licensee to remove the reference to a person with a severe disability. Section 6 amends the definition of public property to include property of municipalities and school districts, which is what caused the sponsors a substitute. Section 7 adds definition of school district. Section 8 repeals the section relating to vending facilities operated by persons with severe disabilities. Section 9 indicates that the Act applies to vending facility licenses issued and vending facility contracts entered into on or after the effective date of this Act. Section 10 states that the Act does not affect a contract entered into before the effective date of this Act. That's the basis of the bill before you. You can note that the bill has a zero fiscal note. There is an accompanying memorandum by Teresa Bannister, Legislative Counsel, who I believe is online to explain, if needed, why we are removing the word, the other names of disabilities from this act in order to give priority to the blind, and that it not be an equal protection problem, since this appears to be an economic matter under federal law, and the scrutiny is minimal. And she could better answer any legal issue regarding that.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Obermeyer. And is this the intention of the committee that we will hear the bill today, and we can ask questions, but we will hold it and will not be passing the bill out of committee? We'll take that up at another hearing. But do members of the committee have questions for Mr. Obermeyer on Senate Bill 51? Senator Bernard.
Kind of just help me with this, because I'm struggling a little bit with the disability, severe disability. So at the top of the chain, if you were a blind person and you had a severe disability, would that qualify you to have a notification where you could be a vendor? Are we taking out disability?
Through the chair, Senator Menard, we are essentially taking out the word severe disabilities. And of course, in the example you gave, the blind person would still be given priority, whether they had other severe disabilities or not. And of course, the Business Enterprise Program has to qualify these people that go into these facilities through various regulations and criteria. So it isn't an automatic thing, you know, like a lottery, but it is to permit blind people to be looked at first, and that's essentially the whole basis of the bill.
Further questions for Mr. Obermeyer? We do have people signed up to testify. First, from the Anchorage LIO, James Schwartz of the Alaska.
Yes.
I'm told by staff that we have to take testimony from the Department of Labor first. Don't know why, but I'll find out later. I've been told by staff to take testimony from the Department of Labor first. We have Paula Scavera from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I apologize to people at the Anchorage LIO. We'll get to you very shortly. So both of you are going to testify together.
Well, yeah.
Ms. Walsh, Ms. Scavera.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for attending. And if you can give your name and affiliation for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm the Legislative Liaison Special Assistant, Alaska Department of Labor.
Good afternoon. I'm Cheryl Walsh, and I'm the Director of the Alaska Division of Vocational Rehabilitation.
We don't have much testimony to give other than recently we found out there may be some legal issues with the way the bill is written, and so we have Assistant Attorney General Goldsmith on the line from Anchorage to talk about that, and then Cheryl's here to discuss the way the program runs now if any of you have questions.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Goldsmith, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm online, and I'm available for questions.
Great. Then maybe Ms. Walsh and Ms. Goldsmith, if you can tell us what the problems with the legislation are that the department has, issues with the legislation.
Well, neither Cheryl or I, neither Cheryl or I are attorneys, and we don't claim to be attorneys.
Good.
We would rather the questions of the legal, one of the committee members asked the questions to the attorney, assistant AG of what the legal issues are, because I don't want to give legal advice.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Scavera.
And I think
Senator Davis.
I do believe that we have on the phone, if not here in the room, the drafter of this bill. They might also want to speak to that.
We do have
to have the lawyer come on and say that he's here to answer questions, but what I want from him is what is the concern that they have. No one has stated it.
So okay, we have Henry
stated for us. I won't need okay. to do it.
Great. Mr. Bannister, are you online as well?
Yes, I'm here. This is Terry Bannister.
Terry Bannister, sorry. And you're available for questions as well. Can you answer Senator Davis's question?
I couldn't quite hear what her question was. I was listening, but I couldn't quite. Could she repeat it, if possible?
Yes, Terry. I did not really ask the question of you. What I said is, we have two people from the Department of Labor here. They came to the table and said that they have discovered some concerns that this might be inappropriate language that we have here, and that they have a lawyer online that can speak to it. So he comes on, and he says he's here to answer questions. But whatever the concern is, it's never been put on the table. So I can't ask you the question, but if you have some comment to make about this bill, if you think there might be a possible legal problem, I would like for you to state that at this time.
Through the chair, I originally thought there might be a legal problem, but then I found a case or two that suggested that there was not, and so I do not think there is a legal problem, equal protection problem at this time. And it's in my memo to the Senator Davis.
It is in the package.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Bannister. M.A. Goldsmith, Department of Law, are you online as well?
Yes, I am. This is okay. Arme Goldsmith. I'm an assistant AG with the Department of Law. And I did review this bill, and I think Mr. Obermeyer and Ms. Bannister already identified the issues that I saw, potential issues I saw, equal protection under the federal and the state constitution. I agree with Mr. Obermeyer that the scrutiny would probably be at the lowest level because this involves an economic interest. I think the bill potentially invites a challenge under equal protection or due process, but how the state Supreme Court would deal with such a challenge or how the U.S. Supreme Court would deal with such a challenge is basically impossible for me to say. But I do think it would be subject to the lowest level of scrutiny, which at the state level would be substantial relationship between means and ends, and at the federal level would be rational review.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Goldsmith. Senator Giesler, do you have a question for Ms. Bannister or Ms. Goldsmith?
Yes. I'm just writing really fast on what she just said. Okay. I had a question for Ms. Bannister. I'm referring to the memorandum that she has included here in our packet. And she spoke to item number one, that while she thought initially there was an equal protection issue, she's determined that there is not. I would academically be interested in those cases. You said that there were...
They're cited on the bottom.
Ah, thank you very much. Second question pertains to item number two, direct notification of blind persons. You posed two questions here. Do you have answers to them, or are these questions for the Department of Voc Rehab or the Division of Voc Rehab?
Through the chair, I had addressed these to the senator. I did not know the answer.
So these are questions that we could ask the folks here from Department of Labor in the next couple minutes. That's what you're saying?
That would be my suggestion.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Senator Pascoe.
Certainly, as to either one of the attorneys, as I understand, both of you are in agreement that under either federal or state analysis as to equal protection law, that as this is an economic issue, that it'd be subject to minimal scrutiny. Is the information, and I'm looking to the sponsor statement now where it indicates that there's a statement that the blind are dissimilarly situated compared to other disabled persons in order to potentially survive any legal challenge, should that be supported in this committee?
This is Terry Bannister. In my memo, I indicate that the main criteria will be whether or not the state's objectives are legitimate and whether the actual legislation bears a substantial relationship to its purpose. You're dealing, so those are the criteria. See a problem about the being dissimilar from blind persons, they are, I think they could be, their category is intact and established, so I don't see a problem with that.
Thank you, Mr. Bannister. Mr. Senator Pascan?
Is there an equal protection argument between categories of disadvantaged people, meaning blind people compared to other disadvantaged? That's what I'm trying to focus upon. And where it says here, blind are dissimilarly situated compared to other disabled persons. Do we need to support that in here to withstand any potential legal challenge?
This is Terry Bannister. I don't know what you mean by to support it. It's always good to have your specifications, your reasons. I mean, in cases like this, perhaps, if you're worried about a challenge, to have them stated so that it's more clear to the court what your reasons were.
Thank you, Ms. Bannister. Further questions from Ms. Bannister from committee members? Ms. Cavera and Ms. Walsh, do you have anything to add from the department?
I think I would, for the record, Paula Scavera, I think I would like to have Cheryl explain the program now, because there is a program in existence now, and I think it would help the committee.
Ms. Walsh.
Chairman Egan and members of the committee, it is a quite complex program, so I would like to first point out the way that we administer it. And you'll see in existing legislation that individuals who are blind have priority at this time. They have first priority already established in current statute, and that is the way that we currently operate the program. And I guess I'd like to entertain questions, because I think there's been a challenge. There's an assumption been made that we don't operate it in that manner. So I guess if I don't know the particular basis for that assumption, but we implement the current state statute recognizing that individuals who are blind have first priority.
Currently. Questions for the department? Senator Pascan.
Just as a matter of foundation, do you have an opinion that blind people should, as an economic matter, continue to receive that first priority?
I think because I represent in the programs that I administer all people with disabilities with barriers to employment, I don't feel comfortable making that decision. They have on a federal level made that determination, and all the federal properties that we administer, the six federal properties, are only available to people who are blind. The state statute allows people with significant disabilities. However, blind individuals still have first priority.
Senator Pascan.
Do you have an understanding or an awareness of the support at the federal level for the establishment of that priority?
It's a longstanding priority. I don't have the particular date, but it goes back, I believe, into 1930s. So it was established many, many years ago, and it has continued. And it has been, because I think originally many people who were blind did have dissimilar advantage in the economy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Senator Bernard.
Thank you. I'm just trying to get a sense of do you feel that we have established being sensitive and kind to the blind what we currently have on the books?
Through the chair, Senator Menard, we make every effort to first make the opportunities available to blind. Where the issues, I believe, sometimes begin and is because if an individual has a current sight, and the way the Randolph-Shepard Act was designed is to provide an economic opportunity to someone. So if you have one sight, we believe that to take another sight over because maybe there was not another blind person who was interested in it, and to the exclusion of another person who does not have an economic opportunity or a business available to them, that's where we limit the individual to one particular site. And that's where where you start to split hairs about who has first priority.
And then I have and I don't know if this is maybe for the bill's sponsor or if you can answer this, but on page 2, line 22 of the bill states, the state will provide the training and supervision necessary to enable blind persons and severely disabled training and supervision to provide the equipment and the initial stock necessary to operate bending facilities. Is there a cap on what is to be considered allowed, I guess? And does the fiscal note reflect any ongoing, like, equipment replacement costs and maybe even, like, technology upgrades? I'm probably getting way too deep on this. But.
Through the chair, Senator Menard, the funds for the program are primarily through the client services program that we receive funding and also through a set-aside that the we refer to them as vendors, that they feed back into the program. So there's no additional cost that we would see.
Okay.
And we do provide the initial stock and equipment for a site. And then the monies that are generated and through the set-aside continues that.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Ms. Bannister's legal comments on the bill as the drafter, she asked the question whether the list of blind people was available, and I'm sorry, I lost my page here that it was on. Here it is. Can the agency use its vocational rehab records to contact blind people directly, or are they confidential? Can you answer that question?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, we don't maintain lists of people, but we do know who are the people that we are currently serving and the disabilities that they have, and they work together with their counselors to determine an appropriate vocational goal, and sometimes that would include entry into the business enterprise program. And then we currently have two people who are, I believe two people, one or two, that are currently in training to become licensed vendors. Because you become a business owner, and so it's more than just indicating an interest, is that you have to have kind of an entrepreneurial spirit. You have to be interested also in the types of businesses that are available, and generally those are espresso stands, snack bars. Some of them we do have some larger military dining contracts, and so it takes a significant period of time in order for a person to be trained to take over a site, and then they compete with the current people who have sites, because if someone who has more seniority in the program, they could bid on that site and take that site over if they were interested and give up their current site that they have and make that one available to someone else. So it's kind of within the program there's movement up as well. I'm not sure if that answers it.
Well,
but we don't maintain an interest.
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Walsh, it sounds like what you're describing then is kind of a short list of qualified individuals that could take these vending sites. So in the Section 3 of the bill where it talks about it's on page 3 and it's Section D as in Delta, and actually C as in Charlie, it talks about the agency may contact a person. No, actually it's D Delta, but contact blind persons directly. The agency shall work with them to let them know about this opportunity. So this is a short list, and you have identified the people that are qualified to take these vending sites already.
Through the chair, we may have people who become interested in the program and then they contact us directly.
Okay.
We also work closely with the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, and they may identify someone who may have an interest or some potential. We don't go and solicit separately from that. The competitions are advertised, so. But the people who are eligible to bid on a site would already have to have been licensed through us.
Okay. All right. Great. Mr. Chair, could I ask one additional question? I'm going to refer now to this chart. Have you seen this chart?
Mm-hmm.
You can look at mine. What I'm wondering is if the folks on it, it lists who the vendors are. I think there's one site that doesn't, it doesn't identify the name of a person. It says something about a one-year contract. Are all those individuals blind individuals then that qualify under this existing statute?
Through the chair, there's one individual on here who has who qualifies because he has a severe disability.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And if you had a, did you?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. He said as one. Are you referring to the state list or are you talking about the federal list? Because I thought the federal list says that the blind person has preference. How many blind people on this list that she just gave you do we have holding vending license at this time based on this chart?
All of the federal sites.
Of course, I know that. So how many is in the state?
Through the chair, we have one, two, three, and then we have one that's currently under a one-year contract. It's been a site that's been difficult to fill. If you look at the National Guard Armory in Fort Richardson, it's been difficult to fill that position with an individual who's blind because it is on Fort Richardson, and sometimes it's difficult to get because many people have drivers if they're blind. There's other reasons why that has not necessarily been attractive to people. And sometimes we have operate contracts if we're trying to have somebody that's in the process of being trained and to be a vendor. Sometimes we'll have, it's not on here, but we have had sites that have closed in the past because we have not had an individual who was blind that was interested in taking those sites over as well.
May I continue with my
report? Senator Davis.
According to this chart, you have a total of 12 sites throughout the state of Alaska. You said there's one that's not identified on here, which would make it 13 if there is such a site. Is that right? A total of 13, based upon the fact that we have 12 here. These are all the sites throughout Alaska, right?
Through the chair, Senator Davis, that's correct.
Okay. And you said out of the names down here, that's listed under the Alaska State Facilities, out of that number, how many of these people are blind?
All but one.
All but one are blind. So everybody on this list is blind except for one person? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
That's because the federal they are, and the state you're saying they are also.
That's correct.
Okay. And it, I have, I guess there's going to be testimony that's going to be given. They might not agree with that, but if these are the sites that they have for the blind, I know there were some changes in the law. And at some point, it made it difficult for blind people to be considered at the top of the list because you pull in all these other people. But I also want to say that we extended this bill to include other sites that's listed in this bill, which would give more opportunities for not only the blind but any other handicapped person to be able to bid on those facilities. And so I see that as a good thing about this bill. So far, I have not heard you say anything necessarily positive about the bill. And I was wondering if you thought that we are on the right track by expanding the facilities.
Through the chair, Senator Davis, I have not had an opportunity just to hear from anybody about what it means to go into a municipal site or into a school district site. So I'm not sure of the implications to the program, and I'd be happy to work to understand what they are. I'm not testifying in opposition to the bill today.
Oh, I understand.
We're here basically neutral at this point to try to understand the need for it because we believe that the current statute does give first priority.
Okay, and I never indicated that I thought you were testifying against the bill. But I will make this statement, since this is my bill that I introduced, and that if you had some concern from the Department of Labor, someone should have contacted my office to let me know that prior to coming here to speak it at the time that this bill is introduced.
For the record, Senator Davis, I stopped by your office last week, and I don't know if you were in town or out of town at the time I stopped by.
I really don't know when you stopped by. As of Wednesday, I was not in my, but everything was shut down. All the rest of the time, it would have been. And I'm not questioning where you came to my office or not, but I would like to say in the future, I would like to be notified about any concern that you might have on a bill that I'm going to introduce.
For the record, Senator Davis, I know it was before Wednesday because I left Wednesday also. So I can't remember if it was Monday or Tuesday.
And we could talk about that in private. We don't have to continue with that.
Okay, thanks, Senator. Further questions?
I have just
Sarah Bernard.
Just one question of information, if you can help me out. The State of Alaska, the Business Enterprise Program. I'm looking that there's 6 snack bars that they're working at, 2 military dining, 2 vending machines, but then there's one that says Federal Building Anchorage, it's dry stand, and I don't know what dry stand means, and it says Bill's mini cash. Do you know what that is? Can you?
Through the chair, Senator Menard, I would actually have to get more information. I believe that that's where they sell some magazines and some other types of.
I didn't know if it was clothes or.
No, it's. I don't think that they're actually preparing, like sometimes they do espressos and that. He's not preparing that type of.
I just wondered because it was at the Federal Building in Anchorage, so I was.
I can get you more information on that.
Okay, just thank you.
Great, thank you. Further questions for Department of Labor staff. Ms. Bannister and Ms. Goldsmith, you can stay online just in case. And we do have 3 folks that are signed up to testify. And, again, I apologize to the Anchorage LIO, but we're ready for you now. James Schwartz, representing Alaska Independent Blind. James, if you can give her your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Yeah, my name is James Schwartz. I'm second vice president of the Alaska Independent Blind.
Welcome.
And I'd like to testify for this bill. I've been involved in this program since 1983, both as a vendor and as a director of the program. I served in that position from 92 until 95. At that time, this issue came up of the severely handicapped. I had a gentleman apply for entrance into the program, and I denied him. And that eventually led to my resignation. My interpretation of the severely handicapped portion of the CHANCE Act is this, that it was to be a separate program, an entirely separate program. As it states within the statutes, they even made provisions for the severely handicapped to have their own committee for active participation in the administration of that program. And why I believe that we need clarification on priority to the blind is that in recent years that has been violated. I currently am a vendor in the program. I operate a espresso stand in the Alaska Native Medical Center. I applied for another facility that no other blind person had applied for, and a non-blind person whose disability was he's dyslexic was awarded that facility over myself, a blind person. So explain to me how first priority to the blind came into play here. I also think that in Cheryl Walsh's one of her comments was, it's splitting hairs. Well, I think we need to a better interpretation, and I think this bill does that. The Randolph-Shepard Act was created in 1936, and the reason for its creation was there was a huge group of veterans that had returned from World War One who suffered blindness. Blindness was a cause of was one of the causes from exposure to mustard gas. And the reason it was created, because there were no opportunities to put these people to work. Since that time, all states except one, Wyoming, has adopted this act, following in suit, along with the federal act. Only two states have provisions for severely handicapped. Georgia is one, and they've never enacted it, and Alaska is the other. And I lost my train of thought here.
Yeah, Mr. Schwartz, if you can summarize, please.
Okay, I would just like to say that the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, they were created to find employment opportunities for the handicapped. There's a little piece of pie in there that the blind have, and I would like to keep that and the priority for the blind in that program. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Schwartz, and thank you very much for taking the time to stand by and present your testimony. We do have a question from Senator Giesel for you, if you can stand by, please.
Yes.
Yeah. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schwartz, you commented that you had applied for a second location. And
yes.
as I'm looking at the list here of folks that are vendors for different sites, I see another gentleman here that has two sites. And yet I heard Ms. Walsh comment that it sounded like she was implying that each individual could only have one site. What is your understanding of how many sites an individual can have?
There's nothing in either program, in the federal Randolph-Shepard vending program or in our own current Chance Act program, that limits the number of sites. My interpretation is that if you have the qualifications, you can have as many sites as you can handle. And I would also like to give you the, if you don't mind, the description of a dry stand. Mm-hmm. A dry stand is a stand where all products are prepackaged, like soda pop, candy bars, magazines. That's the interpretation or definition of a dry stand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Schwartz. That completes questions for you, and thank you very much again for testifying. Next, we have Lynn, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Corral.
Thank you to the chair and to the committee members and to DVR, the state of Alaska as well, and to the people from the Department of Law. One thing that hasn't been mentioned,
ma'am, can you give your name?
70 to 80% of blind people are unemployed or underemployed. Do you understand what that means for us? There isn't a recession or a depression every once in a while in a cycle, but every day of our lives. People don't see, I have two master's degrees, people don't see us as being capable. They see our blindness first. They don't see what our capabilities are. They don't see that we have things that we can actually give to other people. I happen to conduct workshops on abuse against people with disabilities, and the worst abuse comes from institutions, from state and federal governments, because they do not understand what our capabilities are. The biggest employer of people with disabilities and blind people is the federal government, just because it was the most friendly to us, but even the government, and I tried to get jobs in the city of Los Angeles, and there were 67 of us who got the top score, and I could never find a job in the City of Los Angeles system when I had, before I had any master's degree, and now I have two. And so I think when I first heard about unemployment, underemployment of blind people, when I was a young woman of about 15, 16, because I was blind all my life, I heard from a friend of mine that a person who had a master's degree committed suicide because he could not find a job. Now, you may think this is just a problem of the 60s or 70s or the 80s, but the rate of unemployment and underemployment is still an issue today. And for somebody who's not disabled or severely disabled, and by the way, blind people are considered severely disabled, to take a job from a blind person who has fewer opportunities because of attitudinal barriers and other barriers, and we are considered, I read this book in the 80s called Blaming the Victim, the worthy poor. We don't want to be the worthy poor. We want to have the same opportunities, the same upward mobility, the same chances as everybody else. That's why I'm going to start my own business, not in the business enterprise program, but my own business, because I am tired of people not understanding what my capabilities are. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Question, Senator Giesel.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Correll. Could I ask you a question? Do you know if there's a waiting list of blind folks that would like these vending sites? That may be information you don't have, but perhaps you do.
I thought there was a waiting list, but I'm sure that Ms. Walsh and Ms. Guevara could give you better information, but I thought there is a waiting list.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Thank you again for your testimony, Ms. Correll, and thanks for waiting around. Next is Sandy Sanderson. Ms. Sanderson,
thank
if you,
you
could give your name and
I appreciate, first
for the
of
record.
All, your great committee hearing the bill. And I believe it's extremely important that this bill passes. 1995, when the National Guard Armory out in Fort Richardson was built, there were two blind people waiting to bid on that facility. They never got a chance to bid. That facility was given to a man who isn't even severely disabled, he's dyslexic. Now, it was just given to him. Do you understand there is no such thing as priority when it's not utilized? And that's why we felt that we had to bring this bill to our legislators and to have it promoted and accepted. So, as you can see, there was no priority there. They just gave it to him. And that's what we've got to stop. And I thank you so much again for hearing our bill and putting it in your committee. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and again, Mr. Sanderson, I apologize, Sandy. And thank you again for taking the time to stick around and testify this afternoon. Questions for Mr. Sanderson? Seeing none, you're off the hook, and we thank you very much for the testimony you have given, and that completes public testimony on Senate Bill 51. Again, we will be holding this bill over for one more committee meeting, and thank you very much, Senator Davis, for presenting the bill. And we have one more to go, and hopefully we can...
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Giesel.
There were two questions that I asked. I wondered if Ms. Walsh could answer. One being, is there a waiting list of disabled folk? And number two, what was the second question? Oh, can an individual have more than one site, as it appears on the list that they can?
Okay, Ms. Walsh, if you can come forward, please, again, as a representative of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Glad you stuck around.
Mm-hmm. For the record, again, my name is Cheryl Walsh, and through the chair,
I'm not aware of any waiting list. We have some people in training at this time. I'm not aware of anyone that's on a waiting list. And the issue about having multiple sites, you'll notice on that list that there is one gentleman that has two sites, and that is because it takes two sites in order for it to generate enough income to be a viable site. And you will find, and often in the state properties, that there's not an there are standards about how much business has to be generated in order for it to be a viable site to have enough income. And if you don't have a rather large building, or say the military contracts can throw off pretty good income, or if you're in a hospital facility, but some of the smaller sites require us to put two together, and so they're actually only considered one site. They're just two locations.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Senator Giesel. Thank you, Ms. Walsh. As long as you're here, are there any other questions for the department? CNN, thank you, and I'm sure we'll see you again. Great, thank you very much. Thank you again, Ms. Goldsmith and Ms. Bannister, for staying online. And because of our committee time change, we're going to try to vacate the Belts Room at 3:20 this afternoon because they're setting up for another committee meeting at 3:30. So just a warning that we'll be trying to get out of here at 3:20. Next to come up before us, Senate Bill 81. Again, Mr. Obermeyer, thank you very much. Senator Davis, would you like to present, please?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill that you have before you now is a bill that I have introduced simply because I felt there was unfairness in procedures that's been established in our state for retired individuals. As you know, the Affordable Health Act allows dependent children to stay on their parents' insurance to age 26 without even being in college. There was a cutoff as long as they were in college, and at 21 or 22, they were removed from that. And not only do they take, as long as they are single, they are qualified to be on the parents' insurance, but we have identified that we would not provide that opportunity to the retired group. And so this is what my bill addresses. And I would let Mr. Overmyer read the statement and go through the bill with you so that you can begin to ask your questions.
Great. Thank you, Senator Davis. Thank you. Mr. Obermeyer.
Yes, for the record, Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The bill before you, Senate Bill 81, is an act establishing a standard for the procurement of group life and health insurance for retirement systems for certain public employees as a requirement that dependent coverage medical benefits provided to the system's retiree members may not be less than dependent coverage medical benefits provided to the system's active members. This bill came up before I read the statement because after, as Senator Davis indicated, the Affordable Care Act required that all insurers in this state, and Ms. Linda Hall is in the building, is in the room here to confirm this, they were required by September 23rd last year to see that all dependent insured would be up to age 26. The state took it upon itself, since it often follows in its own retirement plan that in many cases have been considered exempt from ERISA, and I have our drafter online regarding this, they decided they would allow active employees to have dependents on their plan through age 26, becoming effective July 1 of this year, 2011. But they specifically said, even in their own website, that the retirees' dependents are excluded. And they cited federal legislation explaining that. I asked for a memorandum, which is in your package, from our own legal department, our legislative legal staff, to interpret that language, and they actually have a contrary opinion. They feel that those retirees should be in this plan. But in the absence of that, we felt we had to move forward with this bill in order to try to bring these retirees' dependents back into this plan. And I don't want to go in. I'll point out issues in that memorandum that are very specific. And it's very involved and very complex matter. I didn't want to bring it to your attention initially. Let me just read the sponsor statement quickly. It's not a long statement. SB 81 requires that dependent coverage medical benefits of retirees in certain state retiree systems be no less than that of active employees. Active employees may enroll the dependents to age 26 effective July 1, 2011. The prior cutoff date for this group was age 23. The state's voluntary change in the active employee medical benefit plan matches the private insurance mandate under the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, which required that insurers, the state's not an insurer, it's self-insured, provides dependent insurance coverage to age 26 effective September 23, 2010. And I believe Linda Hall could confirm that all insurers in this state have complied with this law. Although the state is not a regulated state insurance company, but rather self-insured government employer and exempt, and that's questionable according to our new interpretation from ERISA, it provides medical health benefits for the four retirement systems affected by this bill. Public employees' retirement system, teachers' retirement system, retirement systems of judges, justices and judges, and elected public officials' retirement system. This was in effect for only about a year, starting in 1975, but some of those people are still in the plan, so we drew all of them into the plan, and they're all listed on this very short bill on line 9 and 10 of the bill. Those are those statutory references to those four public retiree groups, that are state retirement groups in Alaska. While state health benefit plans are not subject to the Federal Employee Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA of 74, which establishes minimum standards for pension plans in private industry, they are covered by the Public Health Service Act, PHSA, at least with respect to dependent coverage provision of the PPACA, the Public Patient Protection Affordable Care Act. But if and that's in the memorandum that you can look at later on page 3 in paragraphs under the statement that says, program regulations appear to us to require dependent coverage for adult children under the state retiree health insurance plan. So although there is a difference of opinion by the state's Division of Retirement and Benefits and Legislative Council as to exempting retiree health plans based on interim final rules under the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, without formal court interpretation, it is far easier to require coverage immediately under this bill than wait for court action or federal mandate later. So that's essentially the reason that we brought the bill. We're trying to draw these people in. We feel they should be in now, but in the absence of that, and with the fact that we haven't, the department hasn't indicated that they were willing to do so, we moved the bill. Essentially, where we are.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Obermeyer. Questions for Mr. Obermeyer? Great. Thank you very much, Tom. And we do have Dan Wayne from Ledge Legal online to answer any questions that the committee may have. We also have two individuals signed up in the audience to testify. Bob Dahl, if you can give your name and affiliation for the record, please. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Bob Dahl. I'm the president of the Retired Public Employees of Alaska, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear before the committee and in support of this bill. We like to think that all members of the Senate and the House of Representatives will someday be members of RPEA, too. Each year, the RPEA prepares a list of top concerns for the coming legislative session. And I must tell you, frankly, that this item did not make it to that list. In fact, we added it only after the decision was made not to include the dependents of retirees under this coverage, and only after we heard from our members in unprecedented numbers. No topic that RPEA has pursued in my time with the organization has generated as much interest as this one. Because it was a relatively new topic to us, and because we wanted to determine the apparent level of interest, we decided to poll our members to establish some numbers. We conducted the poll by email during the month of February of this year. From some 1,050 respondents, a response rate of 68%, those we had email addresses for, we determined that 159 retirees had one or more children under 26. The total number of children was 231, and of those 231, 140 were in the age bracket from 21 to 26. We estimate from this sample about 70 dependents would fall into the 23, 24, and 25-year-old age frames, the target of the bill. And of those, we also estimate that about a third of them would have some other kind of coverage. They would be in the military or have employed coverage on where they're employed, but some other kind of coverage. Retirement and benefits has its own numbers, and I'm sure they're based on different criteria, but those are the results that we got from our members. There's no doubt that there exists a small but intensely interested group of retirees with children under 26. From the written comments presented in the survey, in response to the survey, it appears that this is that this coverage is a primary concern to women. In many cases, we imagine that they have postponed their childbearing until they are well established in their state service and now find themselves retired with children of relatively young or relatively older age, but still dependents. They are also the group that is most likely to be to have a continuing concern with their dependents' health care if their spouses have passed away or if they're departed for some other reason. RPA members understand that the issue of cost to the state is involved in any extension of Alaska Care benefits. The majority of us have been supervisors with our municipality or with the state. We know what a budget is, and we know that most things that are worthwhile have a cost. We also know that it's possible to construct a post-retirement dependent health care plan in which the retiree shares some of the cost. We already do that in regard to DAV, dental audiovisual, optional life insurance program, and long-term care. And we would urge that consideration of some similar arrangement for dependents that would take them off Medicare and reduce the cost of the program and yet impose little or no additional cost to the state. Retirees would enjoy the benefit of participation in a group health plan in which they were participating, but for a finite period, whatever the ages of their children might be. Finally, Mr. Chairman, we ask the committee to think of these dependents, these under 26 dependents, as more than just spreadsheet numbers. They are, in fact, the next generation, about which we hear a great deal of concern expressed. We believe that the same concern that the state of Alaska has for the dependents of active employees should extend to retiree dependents who are part of that bright future that we all seek for Alaska. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Dole. Questions for Mr. Dole. Senator Pascha.
Yes, has the Division of Retirement and Benefits provided you with a legal opinion to support their position?
Through the chair for Senator Pascha, no, we have not addressed it to them, Senator. Thank you. As a matter of fact, this is the first time we've had a chance to discuss it publicly. But I do hope that it offers some consolation for those who are concerned with the cost of any additional health care coverage.
Great. Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Dahl? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dahl, I was taking notes when you were speaking, and maybe I misunderstood you, but it sounded like in the last maybe three or four sentences, you moved from talking about the retirees' beneficiaries to the retirees themselves being taken off Medicare. Could you explain what you were talking about, or did I misunderstand?
For the chair, for Senator Giesel, no. I was referring to the dependents who would have no alternative if they had no medical coverage, but to go to a Medicare source for their care. And I know that that's a concern for the state, so I hope that it would be an attraction idea.
Could I ask a clarifying question? Medicare, even if they're under 20?
That's probably.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Giesel. Thank you very much, Mr. Dahl.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time, Bob. Next to testify is Marie Darlin. Marie, if you can come forward, give your name and affiliation for the record, please.
My name is Marie Darlin, and I am the member representing the Legislative Task Force for AARP in Juneau here, and you have a letter from us in support of this, and which actually says some of the same things that Mr. Dahl did. We really want to point out that this then does bring more parity then for your active employees of the state and retirees, which it seems many times by the time they become retirees, they're going to get lost in the shuffle of, all right, whatever else comes along, then they just get left out. And this has happened in the federal as well as the state. I can verify that. So it always means you have to come back then and include the retirees into whatever benefits were given to the employees. And this does have an effect because it then makes a difference for some people who maybe are planning retirement, but they have not gotten the letter from the state telling them that when you retire, you're not going to be able to include your children up to 26 on your retirement, on your medical care. So if they go ahead with their plans to retire, then suddenly find out that they're not going to be able to include those children. Many of those people have changed their plans for retiring because they feel they have to cover those children until they are at that age and hopefully maybe by that time out of college and so forth and so on and on their own. But to try and get health care coverage for those students then, and they can't do it through the state, is just almost prohibitive. And whether they end up on the kids having to apply for Medicaid or not, that's always a questionable thing. But nevertheless, it does make a difference then for people who would have planned to retire but have changed their plans and work longer. And then, of course, that always creates problems when you're planning that people are going to be retiring and they don't, all of that. And it's all in our letter here. So it's just to say that we do feel this is important and necessary and would then provide that equality again between your active employees and your retirees. And that's it, and I thank you for your
great. Thank you very much, Ms. Darlin. Questions for Ms. Darlin? Marie, thank you very much. Good to see you again.
Okay.
Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Again, for committee members, we do have Dan Wayne from Ledge Legal online. If there are any questions for committee members,
I would have
Senator Pasquin.
Mr. Wayne, have you received from the Division of Retirement and Benefits a written legal opinion supporting the Division of Retirement and Benefits position?
Through the chair, the answer to that question is no, I have not received anything like that.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Wayne? Dan, thank you very much for staying online all this time. And I'm assuming we'll see you next time we bring this piece of legislation up. However, we will hold this piece of legislation as we're going to hold Senate Bill 51, and we will, again, not be hearing Senate Bill 70 today, but we'll be bringing it up at another meeting. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the pieces that isn't here is a fiscal note. What will this cost? Could we ask for that?
We do have the fiscal note, and I thought that you had it. But, Mr. Chair, may I speak to that also?
Senator Davis.
And I didn't mention it because I thought everyone had it. There was concern about it, but the money is not going to be paid by the state. And once I had that figured out in my mind that most of the money would be coming from their retirement plan, the retirees. I don't think that's going to end up being quite of a problem. And I'll just make this closing statement as far as the bill, that all I have to say, I appreciate the fact that you brought this bill forward here. I think it's an important piece of legislation. I think that some action need to be taken on it. And you have to look at the age group that we're talking about. They don't require a whole lot of medical treatment and health. So it's not that it's going to be that expensive, but you leave them off, and they go to hospitals, to the emergency rooms, and Medicaid, and wherever they can get their treatment. Mm-hmm. You pay later down the line that way, and you'll pay less if you take an action on this bill at this time. And that's all I have to say about the bill. Mm-hmm. I look forward for it to come back at a later time.
Great. Thank you, Senator Davis. Senator Pascan.
Is anyone from the Division of Retirement and Benefits going to appear before us to establish the foundation?
We'll request that and make sure that somebody from the division is here.
Yes, we could do that.
You know, and I would like to know if it's just a position as compared to a legally supported opinion.
Yeah, I don't have a problem doing it. We'll get with the chair and get the things that we need. Pretty much I see confusion already because I hear one group saying we don't have to provide it, and I see our legal folks saying that's not necessarily true. So if you just lay out what you want, we'll bring it back as much as we can and make sure that the retirement people are here or online, if not here.
I want to know if it's just somebody in the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Well, I would try to get up, that. I would try to get
so
it.
So to speak. Yes. Or whether they did their due diligence.
And my staff has something. He might have something to add to that.
Through the chair, Senator Pasvan, two things. First, Mr. Puckett, the acting director, is in the room, I believe. He was here. Yes,
he is here.
It is getting late, and you may want to postpone that. And I apologize as to the fiscal note. I just received this the other day myself, about 24 hours ago. I thought Dana would have received it and maybe distributed it. And I could give it to you, but Senator Davis was correct. It does indicate at this time, on the last paragraph, that the increases in cost to provide this additional coverage we paid from the Retiree Health Trust. My only concern about this was that I understand from Mr. Puckett was that the Buck consultants had worked with Wells Fargo in putting together numbers that were based on actuarial facts that may not be relevant to this particular population group. And they had a high, a low, and a medium, and they picked in between. The best scenario is half of what this fiscal note is. I think the fiscal note still may have to be reexamined at some point, whether it's paid for by the retiree trust or any other process. So that was my only concern about that.
Great. Thank you very much, Tom. And Senator Davis and my staff will work together, and we'll get the information together for all members at the next meeting. Unless you want to hear from Mr. Puckett right now.
No, I was just wondering if he could indicate whether there is a legal opinion or not, and if there is, if he could provide it to Mr. Obermeyer, and, you know, at least we'll get started somewhere.
I can do it now, or?
Yes, hold up.
Mr. Puckett, sure, come forward.
Yep. 6 minutes.
Yep.
And through the chair, if I may, the rationale for Dan Wayne's memorandum was based on the website that gave us the information.
Thank you. Mr. Fargo, if you can come forward, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Puckett. I'm acting director at Retirement and Benefits. And the question is, did we have a legal opinion? We did. We had an opinion from Department of Law and also from Ike Miller, who is the legal team that provides tax consulting for us. And I didn't bring those with me. I can certainly provide those to you if you need those.
Answers.
Great. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Prager. Yeah, I think the answer, I think it's yes.
Okay.
And we will be scheduling this in the not-too-distant future, another meeting on this piece of legislation. So, anyway, thank you very much for coming forward, and we'll see you at our next meeting.
Okay.
Great. Anything else to come before the committee? Thank you, Senator Davis, for presenting both your bills, and we are adjourned at 3:15.